Hi, I'm Joe. I'm joined by my good friend Adam, and we're getting reacquainted after 20 years apart.
Hello, I'm Adam, and actually, Joe joined me.
This is true. I joined Adam. Well, we've been talking through politics, and we managed to have a great conversation last time about democracy versus republics, and largely agreed that what Adam means by representative democracy is the same thing I mean by republic, and we still largely hold to the same values and principles, differing only really in our priorities and how we choose to apply those principles. So that was a fun conversation. We are going to try to keep the fun and the good feelings rolling today as we talk about the topic of abortion. So this is another one that we've kind of already taken each other's temperatures, and I'm going to go back to the tape and listen to where we each said we were at.
Okay, and that leaves abortion. First of all, the argument for abortion revolves around a religious understanding of life. There is no clear point at which life begins, and while you can make a strong argument for where that point falls, the idea that the soul enters a woman's womb at conception has no basis in scientific fact. I mean, where exactly does the woman fail you here? Does the soul attach to the egg? Is that before it attaches to the wall of the womb? How exactly does this work? Nobody knows, because this is all stuff that people say in churches. It should be a woman's right to choose, seeing as how it is a secular matter. And I will add that when democratic, which is to say liberal, administrations are in power, the abortion rate actually plummets. It falls in general. It's been going downward as we move. But you can see pretty clearly from graphs that the executive decisions that occur as a sort of seesaw back and forth seem to result in fewer abortions when the blue party does it. So if you actually support these things, then it's time to get with the not 21st, the 20th, and maybe 19th century, and go with sex education and the promotion of a woman's safety. Also, and again, I'm not entirely I'm not an abortion fundamentalist, I guess you would say. I mean, again, there is a point, I think, at which life can be said to begin. If the child is viable outside of the womb, then certainly I think a compelling case can be made that it's time to protect it. But there is no rational explanation that can be given for why the thing that exists within a woman immediately after conception is life. There are all sorts of life forms that do not have the rights that we accord that in some cultures. Thank you.
All right. So abortion. I actually find it interesting that you led off with a soul. That's not exactly what I would have expected from an atheist, but I'll run with it. I would argue that life is a biological question rather than a spiritual or a theological question, and that life does start at the moment of conception, because when the sperm and when the egg join and implant in the uterus, in the uterine wall, that is the point where you have a separate biological entity with separate DNA and a separate development path from the mother. It is dependent on the mother at that point in its life, but it is distinctly biologically separate from her. It grows, it divides, it develops, and as time progresses, it divides more and more and more, and the cells become more and more and more specialized, but they do have that DNA template from the moment of conception. Therefore, what is growing inside the mother is a separate and distinct life that is worthy of protection from the very beginning. And so I would say I am an anti-abortion a pro-life absolutist. I would make an exception for the life of the mother, but for nothing else, because that is a separate life that deserves to be respected and protected. You know, once again, I am struck by just how much we each succinctly stated our position, and listening to this recording now 5 or 6 weeks after the original fact, I'm still going, yep, that's exactly it, and I said it far better than I thought I would have said it at the time.
God, we're geniuses. Okay, we were having good weeks, maybe. Anyway, yeah, I still agree with what I said there, and remain interested in what you said. There's at least one principle that you have to accept to some degree when you are, quote, debating, end quote, another person. And we're not so much debating, we've agreed. As this series has continued, we've decided that we prefer having more of a conversation rather than trying to win and knock down each other's points. However, I feel like this argument of yours is almost disingenuous. We talked last week, and I made the point that it's funny that we had the same view, even though we come at it from different directions, or I thought we did. And perhaps that reveals how sometimes we just look for arguments to get to a certain point. But I have a really hard time believing that, you come down so hard on preserving life that, replicable cells must be preserved at all cost. I think without this certainty that there is a soul, this argument would fail to inspire. And there's nothing I can really say about it. You set down your terms and, your article, and now I either have to say, hey, this doesn't work because X, X, and X are not. But I'm just so underwhelmed by the idea that replicating cells is something that we have to go to bat for. Perhaps to put it in light, there's this, we could put it in, and we could go look at euthanasia real quick. You know, what is life worth living? What is, at what point is a person really ceasing to live? When they're brain dead, for example. And then generally you get two types of people who want to keep going and not and can't abide the idea that the person should just be taken off of life support. There are the people who are just desperate to hold on to hope, maybe family. And then there are people who have religious objections. And much as, I don't think you can really say that a brain dead shell of a person is still living. I don't think that these self-replicating cells are, a red line in the sand unless you're factoring in religious reasons.
I would say this is one area of politics where religious reasons does take the forefront in my thinking and in what inspires my view. The Catholic position on life in general, and I am by no means an expert on this. I'm more of a dipper of toes in the water when it comes to this Catholic position of life. But it's one that, as I've looked at it over the years, I have become more attracted to. The idea that life in all of its forms is worth protecting, as that plays out both in an anti-abortion perspective, a pro-life perspective, and in a anti-death penalty perspective. Ever since I've started looking at Catholic teaching in this area more, I've become gradually more and more opposed to the death penalty. I'm not really, at this point, if I'm a death penalty supporter at all, I'm a very, very lukewarm death penalty supporter, edging in the direction of becoming an opponent. I just think life in general, no matter, it goes back a little bit, I guess, to what we were talking about last time with equal protection under the law. And I don't care how horrible of a human being you are, we are all entitled to equal protection under the law. And I would, when it comes to this question of abortion, I would extend it to, I don't care how undeveloped you are, I believe we are all entitled to equal protection under the law, that the unborn are entitled to as much protection, they are as defenseless as anyone else in our society, and therefore they are entitled to even more of our protection because they are so defenseless. And so for me, it really does come down to a philosophical, religious point of view. I think the ultimate question is, what is the unborn in the womb, in the uterus, if you prefer more scientific? I think it is undeniable that it is life, and given that it has separate DNA from the mother, I think you have to say that it is separate life. It is not just an extension of the mother. It's not just a growth that you can cut out, but it is living, and it is unique and distinctive and different. And this question of when does a soul come in, yes, that is a religious philosophical question. Is it endowed with a soul as soon as the, and let me make sure I get my terms here correctly, because I didn't look up at least a little bit of the biology here. The male gamete unites with a female gamete, or oocyte, to form a single cell called a zygote. So would I say that the soul is present and that the zygote is endowed with a soul right at that moment at which the gametes unite? I don't know. I mean, quite honestly, I don't know. But I always tend to, and I think you've mentioned this in previous episodes, my default is to fall back on areas where I can be uncertain, or areas where I can be very certain, and to shy away from uncertainty. And I'm very much opposed to infanticide. And I would say, okay, well, if it's infanticide 30 seconds after birth, isn't it also infanticide 30 seconds before birth? Does coming out of the birth canal really make that much of a difference? And I don't think it does. I don't think it should. And so it's a question of, okay, let's keep walking this backwards. Where would you draw a line that you would say at this point, this life is entitled to legal protection, and at this point, this life is not entitled to legal protection? And I can't draw that line. Maybe you can draw it at viability, but we keep moving viability backwards. So should we keep moving the point at which abortion is allowed backwards, such that abortion is allowed for less and less and less of the term of pregnancy? As a pragmatic matter, since I do try to at least sometimes be a pragmatic politician, I would say, sure, I'd take that compromise. But speaking personally, I don't know where to draw that line of where to say this life is deserving of legal protection and this life is not deserving of legal protection. And so I default to saying, no, we should not allow abortion because it is a life. And at some point, whether it's immediately at the beginning or if it's not until the very end, at some point, a soul comes into question. And then it is immoral to end that life. At some point, that does become equivalent to murder.
All right. So we've come to a position that, as you say, I much more understand, especially coming from you. What you're doing is building a hedge.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's discuss that a little bit. First of all, I would suggest, and I'd be interested if I could get you to agree, that the idea of life beginning with conception is nonsense. So, you know, regardless of where we draw the line or if we're capable of drawing the line, we know that it's not conception. And what I would point to is the fact that something like, and you should probably Google this on your own because I may be mistaken, but an amazing number of conceptions end in miscarriages without a woman even knowing about it. I mean, a huge number of conceptions don't get to the point where it is inconveniencing anybody. And the idea that heaven is one-third made up of people who never actually got their shot or had to go through the mill a few times. To me, that takes the mythology of Christianity and just kind of bends it into an absurd shape. How do you feel about that?
That's one of those areas where to be honest, I punt. And I say, that's God's question, not mine, as to whether heaven is populated one-third with souls who never actually drew breath or even developed a brain stem. That's God's problem. I don't know if it's happening or not, and I'm totally unwilling to take a position, because it would essentially just be picking a side and sticking with it, and that goes against every aspect of my personality. I don't like to take sides unless I have an actual reason for my belief. And in this area, I simply have no reason for belief either way. And that may sound like a wishy-washy answer to some, to which I can only say, sorry, that's who I am. I'm not going to take a position without facts to base the position on. As to whether it is life, I think that depends on how broadly or how narrowly you define life. If you're going to define life on the basis of what I think is the pure biological definition of life, which is you've got cells dividing, you've got an organism that is growing and changing and that has its own distinct processes, I would think it's undeniable that what is in the uterus is life, because it is growing, it is changing, it is developing. But if you're going to define life more narrowly on the grounds of, well, sure, a plant is technically living, but that's not life the way we think of it. Nobody cares if you cut the grass. Then I suppose by that narrower definition, you could argue it's not life. But it's, again, since I don't know where the soul comes into play, and it is developing a hedge, and I do think there's something different about human life versus plant life, and that is human DNA and human cells, and so it is human life in the womb, in the uterus.
But as I understand it, the only reason why human life is so different from other types of life is because of the soul, right? I mean, you're a meat eater, animals, especially pigs, for example, are highly intelligent. In fact, I've regretted, for the record, for some time now, eating an octopus whole and live, because it turns out that eating them at all is actually forbidden in England, because they are amazingly intelligent creatures. And it's a bit of a shame that octopus not only had very, you know, basic panic buttons or something to me, but I'm rather horrified by the thought that it was actually very aware of its surroundings and what was going on while I was eating that thing over the course of 30 minutes. So I guess to restate my question, is not the only distinction between human DNA and animal DNA, the soul?
Yes, essentially. I don't think I would argue with that, and I would say yes, it does come out of a religious perspective that I believe we are all created in the image of God. Some of us perhaps better reflectors than others, but we are, yes, human life is special, whether it's because we're just created in God's image or because we have a soul, however you choose to phrase that. Human life is, for me, categorically different than other kinds of life.
Because of the soul?
Yes.
Okay. All right. A different note then. What about, and I note that I have turned into your interrogator, and I apologize. but I, again, yes, this is something we've encountered time and time again. You know, your very rabbinical idea of building a hedge, or biblical, if you prefer. And this has always bugged me a bit. I feel like I want to say, come on, pick a side, man. There's this, one of the worst Christian books I've ever read, The Shack. Did you ever have the misfortune?
I saw the reviews and decided the reviews were so negative that it wasn't even worth making the attempt.
It's terrible, although it's also oddly, unintentionally creepy. There's a. So I'm just going to go ahead and spoil that the whole time that this man is vacationing with the representations of the three aspects of God, one of them, Jesus, the carpenter, is building a coffin. And it turns out to be for the guy's dead daughter so that she can finally be laid for rest. And it's supposed to be sweet. But the whole time, personally, I just felt myself thinking, get out of there, man. That's you're going into the coffin. Don't you understand? This is going to end with them slitting your throat. Anyway.
Yeah, as observers of pop culture, it is never a good thing when you're alone in a cabin in the woods with three individuals who are building a coffin. That never turns out well.
It's a horror short story waiting to happen. Anyway. But one of the eyeball rolling parts of this, of course, phenomenally popular book is that the murderer of this man's daughter is brought before him. And the aspect of God, perhaps, or maybe it's Jesus, but one of them says, okay, now you get to choose his punishment. And the guy folds and says, I can't choose. I don't know. How could I possibly know? It's just beyond me. And the lesson of this, of course, is that only God can decide. And it just made me, not for the first time, want to throw the book across the room. And I was a Christian at that point. Because we live in a world where we have to make these decisions. We do jail people for crimes and decide what appropriate punishments are. I'm not saying that we always get it right, but these are things that need to be decided. Because the alternative is generally agreed to be worse. You know, there needs to be social mechanisms for dealing with criminality. And in the same way, I feel like informed people can make a decision about where life begins. And it's not going to be right before the mother comes out most of the time, I would imagine. I'm sure there are some people who believe that's totally cool. I think we would significantly outvote them. But surely a dark shade of gray, or you know, a light shade of black, we can come to some form of agreement. Not least because abortion is a long-term issue that humanity has been facing since at least ancient Egypt, when a certain type of reed, I believe, was found to be an excellent form of birth control, and they wiped it out. You know, we've always had women getting abortions because the alternative is often unbearable. And unless there is some significant form of control for that, we have to come to terms with this.
On this topic of the guy in the shack being unwilling to pronounce a punishment for the murder of his daughter, and on your general wish for me to pick a side, I would say this is one area where I do pick a side. I like to believe that were it up to me to execute justice, that I would. I've always despised heroes, whether in comics or in novels or in popular culture, who are confronted with a villain and say, oh no, let me prove I am different from this villain. I will walk away and let you live. I will not kill you like you would have killed hundreds of innocent people. And I've always thought that is such a weak and cowardly response. Here is someone who has committed lots of harm, and it is in your power to execute justice. And let's pretend that it really is justice. It's not vigilanteism or revenge or whatever else. It's just a matter of pronouncing justice upon someone. You take the opportunity to pronounce justice upon them. You end their reign of terror. You get justice for the victims they've already had, and you prevent them from creating any more victims in the future. Now, if it was up to me to actually take the dagger and slit someone's throat, or to do as Ned Stark did in Game of Thrones and take his great sword Ice and chop someone's head off right then and there, Dan Carlin had an interesting meditation on this in one of the Hardcore History episodes on Persia, as to how many of us could actually go into battle and spit our enemies on the end of a spear and rip out their guts looking into their eyes while we did so. And they could do that in the ancient world. And Dan thought, and I think I agree with him, there's not many, if any, of us that could do that today. So could I actually take the dagger and slit the throat of the murderer? I don't know that I would have the stomach to do that, but I would certainly believe that that's what should be done. So I'll pick a side there. And now I've forgotten what the rest of your question was, because I got digressed onto that side point.
I think you have made a good counterpoint, and I will say touche, because yes, I guess you have picked a side. But it seems to me like you're unwilling to wrestle with the complexity of the issue, which, knowing you, I'm not going to say it's abnormal for you, just that you certainly have the ability to wrestle with this issue, and you do in so many other areas.
What I think you were asking, and the thought that went through my mind, it just came back into my mind. What I do is I look at an adult of 27 now, who is, let us say, on a college campus, giving a talk about abortion, talking about how I was someone that my mother wanted to abort, and she either got talked out of it at the last minute, or the abortion failed for some reason, and here I am today, and my mother and I have a great relationship, and she absolutely loves the life we've had together for the past 27 years. I look at that, and I see, in my mind, as it were, a thread stretching backwards, not through space, but through time, where at every point along this thread is a younger version of this individual, the 25-year-old, the 21-year-old, the 18-year-old, the 16-year-old, the 13-year-old, going back notable moments in life, when you turn 10, when you turn 5, and that's a nice big round number, when you're born, when you're at 7 months, when you're at 6 months and it's the start of the last trimester, when you're at 3 months and you're first showing up on an ultrasound. To me, this is an unbroken thread stretching all the way back to that zygote where two cells came together. And there's just this process of life developing in complexity as the cells keep dividing and dividing and dividing, and the cells begin to specialize, and the cells begin to grow in complexity and take on unique functions. It's an unbroken thread that stretches back. And so when I'm looking at it's not entirely a hedge. It's somewhat of a hedge, because I don't know when that soul exactly comes in, but I do know the life that the soul inhabits is this unbroken thread, that if you cut it at any point, you're killing the 27-year-old as surely as if you'd taken a gun to his head and shot him. You know, there's all these fantasies about what if we could go back in time and kill Hitler? Or what if we could go back in time and prevent Hitler's parents from ever having met? That would be the same thing as killing Hitler. And there's an element of truth to that, I think, that it is this thread of history, and more specifically, this thread of life, that abortion honestly horrifies me, because you're choosing to cut this thread, and it's easy to say what we've got is just some barely differentiated cells, that a soul isn't inhabiting those cells yet. There's no human being involved. But I look at it as 27 years down the road, 5 years down the road, 3 years down the road, we would both look at the result of those cells and say, yes, that's a human being, and what you just did today was at the very least, removing that human being or killing that human being.
All right. Well, first, let me note my enjoyment that we've turned this into a science fiction time travel discussion.
There is nothing I cannot turn into a science fiction time travel discussion.
I believe you. But to all of this, I say, come on now. There is a real difference, and morality cannot be judged. The morality of an action cannot be judged according to what its, you know, the unknown possibilities of something are. Okay, let me start simple. The reason why that 27-year-old's testimony touched you, and why the idea of you or my mother or your mother not choosing to have me touches you and horrifies you, is because of your emotional investment in the present. But it's a completely subjective feeling. There's no horror at what was lost if it was never had in the first place. And if you you have not successfully murdered every other strain of reality because this one exists. I suppose in practice we kind of have, because most civilizations are built on ancient genocide. But you see my point. I think this is part of the reason why, for example, the United States has trouble recognizing the evils of slavery and the evils of what we did to Native Americans, because to some degree, this is why the issue of Christopher Columbus is more contentious than the issue of Robert E. Lee, because Christopher Columbus represents this much greater existential dilemma for all of us. We are glad to be here. We are glad that white people found America. And we don't wish that he had never set foot in the Caribbean. You can, and if you're emotionally invested in that, and if you let that investment guide you, then I feel that you certainly can, you know, find yourself repelled at the idea of denouncing his actions. Or you could discuss the matter of rape. You know, all of this sort of turns into this unintended, the more life, the better argument, which is unsupportable. More life is not always better. And if that were the case, then you would have at least a pretty decent rationale for justifying rape. Well, if you don't do it, then Tommy won't exist. Who's Tommy? The child will have. you know, I don't see this as a logical framework that holds together.
I can see what you're saying. And no, I don't think I would agree with that conception either. I agree that more life is always better, and that we should value and protect the life we have, not that we should be hellbent on creating as much life as possible and having this philosophical statement that you must bring into existence every potential life that can be brought into existence. I wouldn't agree with that. But I would say that once life has started, especially human life, there is a duty and a responsibility to protect it. And I've always believed that the long view is important, that you should be looking down the road to the consequences of your actions, not just living in the here and now, saying, well, this has no effect now, so this is a good thing to do. No, you should be looking, what effect is this action going to have in the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 25 years, 50 years? And you should be making value judgments and decisions based on the long-term impact of your decisions. And that's why the example of the student on stage or the young adult on stage resonates with me, not just because I'm in the moment with the person then and there, saying how glad I am that this didn't happen 27 years ago, but that I think you should be at the moment when the woman is pregnant today, looking down the road to 27 years from now. And okay, the decision to abort now may seem like a good one, but what is the long-term impact of that decision going to be? And maybe your life stinks right now today, but maybe the joy from this child is going to massively outweigh that over the next 27 years, and that should be taken into account. Maybe you're not going to keep the baby. Maybe you put it up for adoption, and the joy that that child brings to some other family over the next 27 years is important in your decision. And not just some other family, but that child, him or herself, the joy that that child is going to have just from growing up either with you or with somebody else, that joy and pleasure of life matters. Because when you get right down to it, there are very, very, very few people, vanishingly few people, who would say and genuinely mean it, I wish I had never been born. I wish my entire life had been obliterated. It would be better for me to have been dead than to have gone through this. Job said it. I'm not going to deny that there are perhaps others who have and who have genuinely meant it. But I think in the vast mass majority of cases, that's not true. And so I think the decision you make today should be focused on the long term, not just on the short term. And I'd be a little bit surprised if you would disagree with that.
I don't disagree with the general principle that one should take the long term into account. I think, again, when you say, I don't know anybody who doesn't want life, who would toss away the lives that they've got, you're discounting the fact that the alternative is that they don't exist or they don't know, that they are emotionally invested in this. It's one of those things that's tough to wrap your head around, not existing, not caring that you've ever existed because you never existed. But there's nothing lost that was never there.
I think it's the difference between I can sit here because I am alive. I can sit here and envision two realities, the reality in which I am here and the reality in which I am not here. And I prefer of the two, the reality in which I am here. And
it's called a fear of death, Joe.
No, it's more than that. It's a fear of non-existence. Death is just a mere termination. Non-existence is a complete obliteration. And I think you're trying to say that, well, if we just go with the reality in which you never existed, that's a perfectly good reality too. And I would say, yes, that's true from every other vantage point but mine. And so going back to protecting the defenseless, I think we should be taking into account my perspective as the individual whose obliteration is under discussion.
Well, there you go. You just said it yourself. Every perspective but yours. Yes, Joe is very glad that he's here, and I'm very glad Joe is here. But what about the Tom, Dicks, and Harrys that don't exist because Joe is here? Your parents could have conceived you on a different night, and Joe would not be here. You know, that has to be taken into account. But let me change this a little bit, because that's very abstract. And maybe just let's talk a little bit more about the same question, but with a different example.
Okay.
You have people say at some point, you know, that they're glad that their life is turned out the way it has, because otherwise they wouldn't be the people they are today. They grapple with the fact that what makes them them, their identity, the way they think, the way they act, is not only due to their having been conceived and or raised, but all the actions they took then, even the ones that may have marginalized them, that may have stuck them in a rut of some sort. You find people, a good example is neuroatypical folk who now argue vociferously that they should – that they do not want to be normal, that this is how they are, and they can't imagine being a different way. Personally, I don't have a problem thinking to myself, boy, I wish I'd made some different decisions. And yet, it's a rather stunning thought that any of those decisions that would have been better in the long run might not have left me with Anna. You know, and that's just it. I'm emotionally invested with how I am here now. And so I retroactively sort of justify those past decisions, even though it's entirely possible I might be happier in this alternative world. Because generally, for example, income correlates with happiness. If I were making $40,000 more per year, Joe, I might be a happier person. And there's not much getting around that, scientifically speaking. In fact, while you note the mythology of the fulfilled mother, I think the studies that they have shown, and not that we should give great credence to them, because I have seen up close the sausage making of the university study, but it tends to be that people who do have children later, or who tend to end up with higher income levels because they put it off or had that abortion, and I know a few who have, do report higher levels of happiness, that children actually impact your happiness to some degree, at least in the short term. So I feel like, you know, what you've got this argument you're making, but the benefit is that you get to define your current status as satisfying, which it is, no doubt. Whereas you get to just imagine this field of less satisfying experiences and compete against whatever construct is in your mind.
You're preaching to the choir. I would be the first to agree that children have an impact on happiness, certainly short-term happiness. There are few people more unhappy than the brand new parent who is sleep deprived and has been sleep deprived for the past 6 weeks and is looking forward to being sleep deprived for the next 20 weeks. That is a level of stress and unhappiness that is hard to exaggerate. And telling people that, oh, it's only for a short time, it'll get better. The only reason that doesn't get you punched these days is because people generally have more self-control and there is societal pressures against just punching random strangers. But believe me, as a parent, the only reason you don't get punched by new parents for saying that life is going to get better is that there are societal expectations and pressures that prevent you from doing what you would really like to do. But if you've ever told a parent life gets better, just be aware they've probably wanted to punch you at that moment in time. So I'm well aware of what you say, that just saying, oh, you're going to have a great 27 years is small comfort to the woman who's going through a pregnancy now, and the pregnancy is making life really, really suck. Saying it's going to be better is small comfort to her. I still think that's true, but it doesn't change the emotions of the situation. But at the same time, what I keep coming back to really is this idea of equal protection under the law, that these are all arguments for arguing, not necessarily to the mother, although if she hears the arguments and is convinced by them, so much the better, but for arguing to society at large that our stance as a society should be that human life is special, human life is worthy of protection. It may be more convenient for me to live in a world where your rights are curtailed in some way or another. But we agree that that's wrong and that that's bad. Just because it makes life better for me to run roughshod over your rights doesn't mean that I get to run roughshod over your rights. Your rights still get to be respected, and I have to just deal with that. And I argue that when it comes to the unborn, the same thing applies. Their presence complicates, makes things more expensive, makes things harder, makes people unhappier, and that is all beside the point. They are entitled to have their life protected just as much as you and I are entitled to have our lives protected by society. And as a moral society, we must step in and protect their lives, even if there is a short-term emotional or financial cost. And yes, I would agree we as society should help bear that cost. I'm not one of those Christians who just says we should make abortion illegal and do nothing to help the mother. I think that's cruel, I think that's heartless, and I think it's wrong. I'm a great believer in saying that we should support mothers, and it's something Christine and I have been very consistently doing ever since we got married. I know you and I would have some political disagreements over the best way to support the mothers, but I am strongly in agreement that we should support the mothers to ease the emotional, financial, mental burden of being pregnant. But that doesn't change the fact that we should protect the lives.
One aspect of this discussion that it occurs to me we have not had is the value of human life. Once you take the soul out of the equation, I believe in protecting and human life as you do when it is out there and before the law, because the alternative is unconscionable and really a problem. But as I said last podcast, I don't believe people are equal or that all life is an unalloyed good. In fact, I think it's already demonstrably true that we have a surplus of life, even unto the number of orphans who are awaiting adoption. We don't need more children to give joy to parents who can't have children. There are already way too many. Occasionally, a conservative who saw the math says, "This is nonsense. We could all live inside the state of Texas, or, you know, and the rest of the world could be in Eden." Of course, to which the reply is, "Oh, yes, you're going to let the government tell you where you want to live and enact environmental laws to protect the rest of the world? Wonderful. Welcome to the Communist Republic." It's nonsense. But we are already undergoing, to no small extent, and largely because, I would say, of humanity, a huge extinction era. And so I would suggest that while as a principle we must protect all life, that we should not be promoting this mythology that, you know, there is this great undiscovered violinist / senator in every woman's womb, and we need to make sure that person gets out. We should not be according reality to possibility.
I think I keep hearing you want to broaden the discussion beyond the argument that I'm making.
I don't think we disagree with it. I'm for protection under the law. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. I just want to clarify. You don't say anything I disagree with in those terms. I'm very much willing to protect life, but I mean, at what point does life start? This is not something you seem to want to have a discussion about.
Well, where I think I keep seeing you wanting to broaden it is you want to look at all of the potentialities of life. Should we be encouraging birth? Should we be incentivizing people to have more children? Should we be saying that the universe with 10 billion people is better than the universe with 7 billion people? And I want to take a much more narrow view of abortion, which is in the scenario where a woman is pregnant, what do we do then, and what should be the allowed menu of choices at that point? At the point we are making a decision, what are the decisions that we have open to us to make? And that is the point where I think abortion is impermissible. You know, should we be encouraging people to have 8 children instead of 2? Separate question. Should we be saying that a world with 50 billion is better than the world we have now? Separate question. What I want to look at is just very narrowly, we intended to use birth control and it failed. We didn't even think about using birth control. Birth control was the farthest thing from our minds. Okay, now we are at the point where someone is pregnant. Is abortion an option? Yes or no? And that's where it comes down to me, very, very concrete. And I think separate from separate political discussions we've had or previous political discussions we've had where it's been, I've wanted to go very abstract. In abortion, I want to go very concrete. In this situation, is abortion allowed? Yes or no? So that's where I think you're wanting to broaden it out farther than I'm wanting to have a philosophical conversation.
You've got me. I do try to broaden the conversation. The reason that I keep broadening the conversation is because I feel like we're at a bit of an impasse. And I think that if I discuss with you the issues that I believe are contributing to your strong motivation to build this, to my mind, unreasonable hedge around the issue, that perhaps you will be more open to engaging in that discussion.
Perhaps. The other thing where I think I would turn it around and counter-engage you or become your questioner.
Hey.
You seem awfully unwilling to want to assign a soul to this cluster of human life that is growing and developing. And I can't help but feel that that is, in its own way, a dodge of the issue. I don't have to argue. I don't have to really delve deep into the emotional trauma of saying that you must carry this child even when you don't want to, because I can say there is no soul there, so it's not a human being, so feel free to do whatever you want. And I feel, not just you personally, but since I'm having the conversation with you, I'll personalize it. I feel that that denial of a soul is a dodge in its own way, that maybe I'm dodging by putting a broad hedge and saying, I don't know when the soul starts, so let's just assume it starts at the beginning and go from there. But I feel like you're dodging by saying, we don't know where the soul begins, so let's say it's at some really late point, and that gives us the maximum freedom to maneuver.
Well, I do feel that there are limitations that should be placed on when abortions are proper. As far as my disinterest, or as far as my unwillingness to assign a point at which the soul is in place, let's remember that all of this talk of souls is essentially for your benefit.
True. And you're an atheist. You wouldn't believe in a soul to begin with.
Exactly. And that's well and good. In fact, it helps that one of us believes in a soul, because most of America does. And it's a factor in the political question that we're not going to get away from. It does, yes, make discussion harder for me, because it's like trying to put together a car and every once in a while the person next to you saying, okay, but what about with a thingamabobberhey? You know, this part that doesn't actually exist, that
doesn't
have a place
in the car.
What about the
spirit of the car? You haven't put the spirit of the car in yet.
Exactly. I mean, what hose are you going to attach it to? You know, which side does it go in? And me just being like, would you please be quiet about it? It's not. So you can see how this drives me a little crazy. And then you turn the question around and you say, okay, well, where do you think the spirit starts? And, you know, they say, I don't think we should build the car without it, but I'm not going to put it in. it's absolutely maddening. And so, yes, that would be my, so that's my answer to your question. It's not that I'm, if we can get into the theological issues, then perhaps we can come to some sort of agreement. It seems unlikely that we're going to get any sort of, and in fact, you know, that's exactly what happens. It's tough to find a middle ground when that hedge exists.
So I would turn that further around then and say, okay.
I'm getting dizzy.
Yeah. I'm just going to keep spinning us until you fly off the merry-go-round, and then I can claim victory right before I barf. You've said, and I know you believe infanticide is wrong and murder is wrong. And you've said there should be restrictions on abortion. It shouldn't be 100% any time. So I've got religious beliefs to back up my position. What's the basis for your position? Why aren't you 100% abortion on demand, or even taking the Peter Singer position of infanticide on demand. Because whatever else you may say about Peter Singer, I feel as an atheist, he at least is really, really consistent. From a certain standpoint, I despise him as a human being, and from another standpoint, I admire him as being willing to stick to his convictions, no matter how unpopular it makes him.
I should read more Peter Singer. It's possible that some of his arguments would actually turn me, to be perfectly honest. But I read something recently about the difference between Europe's view of abortion, which in some cases is as restrictive or more so than America's, and Americans' view. And part of it's the common good. Again, it comes to policy. Also, it comes to the same reason that cruelty to animals is wrong. Your children at various young stages in their lives are not smarter than your family dog. There comes a point where they gain the higher ground, but not at first.
Oh, yes, I would agree.
And yet we understand, even if we still eat animals, I think for other factors than pure reason, that we should not torture or simply kill animals. And yes, possibility plays into it to some degree, but only once we have decided that this is the plan, that we're going to have this child. I think it was a column by Jonah Goldberg recently, or at least on National Review, in which the writer said that you'll notice that it's an it until the woman decides to have it. And then it becomes a he or a she and my baby once that woman decides to have it. And of course, what that writer is doing is in theory is flagging hypocrisy, but I don't think so. I think that's really more of a mindset that, you have established at least a possibility at that point. You don't know within that sphere what it is. Within that spectrum of possibility, what's going to happen, but you have made the decision that you're going to admit this child into the human family when the time comes. Beyond that, I might be willing to kill children more than you. I believe in pulling the plug in some cases, if much as with euthanasia, if the child has, if the child is going to be brain dead for the rest of its life and so on and so forth. I don't think you're that hardline of a conservative waiting for a miracle to happen. I don't know. It'd be an interesting question for you. But for me, quality of life is a contributing factor.
The end of life question, it would be a very interesting discussion for another time, because very briefly, I think I agree with you more than you might expect, but less than you might hope, in that I am on board with the idea that not all life is worth extending, and that I think I would say if the machines are the only thing keeping you alive, then there is no longer a moral argument that you must keep the machines turned on. If it is at a certain point, you're 93, you've lived a good long life, your body is failing, your organs are shutting you down one by one, but by God, we can keep you plugged into the ventilator and keep you turned on for another 5 years. But it's not really you that's alive at that point. It's just the ventilator pumping oxygen through your lungs and an artificial heart pumping blood through your veins. Then I would say, yeah, turning off the ventilator, unplugging the machine at that point is not akin to murder. That is just letting life take its natural course. So in depth, that's a whole nother discussion. But in brief, that is where I come down on this question of, okay, I've got a terminal disease and I'm still fine and I'm 53, euthanasia there. I think that's where we would get into some more disagreements. But just to let you know, I'm not necessarily one of these absolutists who says we must keep the body alive as long as the body can possibly be kept alive. My interest has always been more on what is the normal course of things that if left alone, what would happen? And so I look at pregnancy from that viewpoint of if left alone, the pregnancy will develop all the way to an infant who will eventually develop into an adult human being. And we should be looking to preserve that status quo rather than we should be forcing something to happen and to come into being. So I think on that question of life, that's how I would sum it up. Where your perspective, I think, worries or concerns me is the attitude that life has value because we say that life has value, and we protect the young or the old because we feel empathy and sympathy for them the same way we feel empathy for an octopus or a pig, because let's face it, pigs are smart. I'm not trying to be humorous there, but we do. We feel sympathy for pigs because they are smart, and we feel that they do have some level of emotional awareness of the world, if nothing else. And so we protect the very young and the very old, not out of a belief that life is sacred, but just because it would make us feel bad to not treat that life as special. And I think where your perspective concerns or worries me is that idea that if we ever decide life is not worthy of sympathy and empathy, well, then our whole perspective can change. And while that may be true and okay with other areas of politics, I've always felt that life should be treated as sacred, even if you're not religious. Because once we stop treating life as sacred, I think that opens up a lot of very dangerous avenues for societies to go down.
Hmm. Here again, we run into our basic worldview split of the atheist and the religious person. I guess my perspective is you have my position correct. But first of all, I believe in truth. I've always believed in truth. Whether or not I've gotten it right, I understand that we have differing opinions on that. But it was because I was more interested in the truth than I was interested in my own personal security and comfort that I decided I wasn't a Christian anymore. As far as we might change our minds if we don't accord it this sacred status, a human life this sacred status, I would put to you that in my worldview, this idea that sacredness is anything special is an illusion, that what has been deemed sacred has changed throughout history, and that your religious convictions are in their are more social constructs. So there's nothing more I can offer you as far as that comfort. It does horrify me, the idea that we might just start deciding willy-nilly one day far in the future who lives and who dies according to some sort of system. But I would rather base any opposition to that idea off of what I know or believe to be true. And beyond that, no, I guess that'll do.
Yeah, I think that'll do. I think we've done what we set out to do, which was to have a good discussion and to really understand each other's points of view. And I think that's true. I think you understand my point of view. And I think I understand your point of view as well. It's not one that I agree with, but it's one that I can understand and I can, to some degree, respect for its consistency and its, I guess just intellectual consistency with the rest of what you believe. It's not where I am, and I guess I'm okay with that.
Well, I appreciate that.
Well, on that note, I think we'll go ahead and end this week's episode, and I will say, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Good to talk to you, Joe. And looking forward to next week.
Looking forward to it. Yeah, that should be a really good conversation.
Good night, Joe.
Good night.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to Reacquainted and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to Reacquainted, and give it a rating. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following at From Vox Duo on Twitter. That's at FromVoxDuo. Adam is on Twitter. His handle is at Adam Volle. That's Adam Volle. Joe blogs at minorthoughts.com, and he's on Twitter as well, at JMartinDF.
I will say, I have, looking back on these past six episodes that we've recorded, I've enjoyed them. I've enjoyed the discussions. I've enjoyed finding the areas, in spite of how we've changed over the years, the areas that we do still have agreement on. And, you know, it's very gratifying to find that we're both Democrats in the sense that we think political dynasties are a horrible, horrible idea. And just because you share the last name of a previous president does not mean you are in any way qualified to be president yourself, whether your last name is Bush or Clinton or Adams, for that matter.
I think most people would agree with that idea, but that they don't either don't think about it that much or don't want to think about it that much, because it's, I know a lot of my Democratic friends, you know, are very much feel that even if there's something questionable about Clinton, you're hurting her chances by training your fire on her. And, you know, they're not entirely wrong, because, again, we can all multitask, but we all only have so much energy. And what are you going to use yours for? But at the same time, in many ways, it's an excuse too.
Yeah, and my own perspective is, and it's perhaps harsher than anybody else's would be, but my own perspective is, I don't feel like we need to train fire on the sons and daughters of former presidents. I think we should just all have a gentleman's agreement to ignore them entirely, that I don't care how smart, how talented, how witty, how charismatic, how brilliant you are. I feel that the mere fact that you are your father's son or your mother's daughter, or your father's daughter or your mother's son, whichever, should automatically disqualify you from political office. We should just all agree. If Jeb Bush says, I'm running for president, we should just all ignore him. We should not write any news articles. We should not have any interviews. We should just all agree to pretend as though he never said anything at all. Not out of any malice, but just out of a general principle that dynasties are a bad thing.
I'd like that. I wouldn't mind going a step further and having a constitutional amendment that is basically the equivalent of federal policy, or, you know, lottery tickets, that says that if you're an employee if you're related to someone in the organization, then you can't play. You know,
America, the most anti-aristocratic nation on the face of the earth. We put it in writing and we mean it.
Exactly. I'd be for the force of law in that.
There we go. We finally found a political position we can both get behind and a political campaign we can both work on.
I think it would be, and I don't know why people don't. Maybe they do. It's not like I keep up with everything. But if I were a political candidate and I was running up against Purdue III or whatever, I would make it a campaign issue.
I forgot. You guys have had the Purdues down there for a while that have become your own little mini political dynasty.
And the Carters. Jimmy has a daughter or granddaughter or someone who either ran for governor or senator or something. I can't recall. I don't think she won.
No, I don't think she did, but I do recall that being mentioned 2 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Talk long enough and we'll find areas of agreement.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there you go. Sometimes it's not about carefully picking away the differences to find the things you have in common. Sometimes it's just about sanding that sucker down and just applying enough pressure to it until finally there's nothing left but what you have in common.
Exactly. The next time we talk, I'll get to, I think what I'll do is I'll bring out all the postcards you sent me and all the photos Anna posted on Instagram, and we'll just talk through the trip. It's kind of like, I want to hear the stories behind the photos, you know. Okay, so you were in Malaysia or Vietnam or whatever. Just what was it like? And I assume you've got something to say along those lines.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm pleased that you're interested. One of the tricky parts of coming back is just, you know, having had these experiences that really have changed you but feeling like you're just going to annoy people as if you've suddenly got this social karma you're trying to cash in, or you know what I'm talking about? Like, I just had this amazing trip. It was really changed me. And you know, these are people that you often want to push away.
I'm not just a dumb American. I traveled the world. I saw things you wouldn't believe.
I'm enlightened now, as the Buddhists of Vietnam say.
Exactly. You know, this brings me back to the time when I was riding on a Mongol horse out on the steppes, and all of these concerns just seemed petty to me.
Oh, we did. There was one great, maybe I should save this for the podcast, but let me just go ahead and throw it out there. We were in New York City, you know, we just got back, and my brother-in-law asked what we wanted to eat, and he suggested dim sum. He knew a great dim sum place or something. And I turned to Anna and just full, like, without thinking, said, yeah, we haven't had that since Beijing. I'm that person.
Well, you know, speaking honestly for a minute, because I rarely do, speaking honestly, I love the idea of traveling the world. I just hate the actual specifics of traveling the world. I am such a creature of routine and habit, and I am most comfortable when I am inhabiting my routine, that once you actually talk about, wait a minute, this is in a hotel in a foreign country, where I don't speak the language, and I can't ask basic questions because I don't speak the language, and they have different expectations and ways of behaving, and that's just all going to be awkward and uncomfortable, and you know what? I'm just going to stay home. And and that's my feeling going to France, let alone going to something in Asia where it's completely different. And so it's like, I love the idea of traveling and getting all these different experiences. I just hate the specifics of it. And so I like living vicariously through other people. Yes, tell me about your experiences, because then I can feel like I was there without having to actually go there.
Well, bless you, because you are exactly the sort of person that the people who do travel need to exist.
Finally, someone who wants to listen to my stories.
Yeah, we're a symbiotic relationship, you and me here.
There we go.